Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this special edition of the 40 Scenes Fire American Soccer Show, as we now will divulge into the U.S. men's national team debacle in Canada. Currently joined by Carter Krishnire of World Soccer Talk, Robert Hay of SoccerMinnows.com. Hopefully we'll have Neil Blackman on from the Yanks Are Coming podcast. And before I bring the gentleman on, I have to just give out a couple of things about this whole situation. And that is this, is that while everyone is shaking their heads, scratching their heads on this loss in the CONCACAF Nations League to Canada, we have to understand that Canada has every right to fight for a professional result in BMO Field and to go after the USA like it is a World Cup qualifier. Because this is, unfortunately, a FIFA official competition date. Just like the UEFA Nations League, CONCACAF has done their own Nations League as well. They're trying to improve the Confederation. They're trying to improve all of their nations, islands, regions, to go forward and to make this confederation stronger. What we have seen from the United States is very plain and simple. They did not show up. They failed to show up. And now the question comes, is it due to Greg Berhalter? Is it due to the president of Carlos Cordero? Or is it this mysterious board of governors that is really mucking things up with this national team program for right now almost two full years? And the truth is, no progress in sight. Joining me now, of course, as I've already said, we'll have Carter Krishnire on World Soccer Talk, Robert Hay, SoccerMinnows.com. Hopefully we'll have Neil Blackman on to also add on to this. But Carter, you know, it's very alarming to see a national team not caring enough against their opponents. Now, granted that Canada has not done much since 1985 World Cup, but still, though, I've always felt no matter who is in front of you, no matter where in the world rankings they are, including the confederational rankings, whether it's through FIFA or CONCACAF themselves, the opponent in front of you is the opponent that you must take out. It's easy to score seven against Cuba, but then you knew you had a tougher competition with John Herdman and his Canadian side putting a number on our boys.
Yeah, I don't understand why there's a mentality that it's Canada, it should be a simple match, because it's not. I mean, in fact, I would argue Canada, for many cycles, was stuck in the same type of underachievement that U.S. fans who are very arrogant and who really have not grown up since October 10th, 2017. I mean, they make the same sloppy assumptions about the opposition. They do the same thing overrating their own players. They do the same thing creating a toxic environment for their players and coaches. Nothing has changed in terms of that, in terms of the poison chalice of this U.S. job and the fan base. I think it's very arrogant to say, well, Canada, it's Canada. If you look player for player during the era from, let's say, 2005 to 2012, 13, Canada, player for player, was not that far off, at least in their top 10 or 15 players from the United States. But there was a grit, a determination, a structure brought in under Bruce Arena and Bob Bradley that allowed the United States to overachieve internationally, to punch above our weight, a sense of purpose among all our players, a buy-in from the supporters. Whereas Canada had a federation that was dysfunctional, provincial federation that were dysfunctional, that were fighting, were highly politicized. There was corruption there as well. There was even some match fixing going on in their league. But if you look player for player, Canada had Wayne De Rosario, who was arguably the best MLS player in that era. They had guys like Paul Stalteri, Adiba Hutchinson, and Rob Brent, and Julian De Guzman, all guys who were playing at a very high level in Europe. So I think we have an arrogance to say, oh, it's just Canada. They're not that good. We should beat them. Now, if you look at this Canadian team now, they don't have as many high-level players playing in Europe as they did in 2007, when we were very fortunate to beat them in the Gold Cup semifinal. Really got lucky because of a bad officiating call, a terrible officials call in that match. They, player for players, are top 15 guys playing at the same level, if not a little bit lower than our top 15 players. And I said it included guys like Trent, Stalteri, and others, and De Guzman and Dero, who at the time I thought was probably the best player in our league, in our American MLS. But they do have Alfonso Davies, developed here in North America, Edmonton Aviators, Vancouver Whitecaps residency, Major League Soccer, and he's a once-in-a-generation player for Canada. You know, Canada has not had a player like that since Di Rosario. You go further back, they had some really good players playing in England in the 1990s also. But he's a generational player for them. And in a weakened CONCACAF region, he gives them a real shot. The other thing I need to point out, Daniel, about your intro, in fact, this match was like a World Cup qualifier for Canada, because Canada needs to get into the, because of this, you know, we did a whole show, right, on this bad qualifying structure from CONCACAF, this really horrible qualifying setup, in which they have now, they're now moving teams directly to the hex based on their world ranking and getting rid of the earlier rounds of World Cup qualifying. Canada has no choice but to beat the United States in Toronto, and then I think probably need to draw in Orlando in the return leg to get into the hex. So this is a do-or-die match for them, whereas for the U.S. it really didn't matter, other than being embarrassing and allowing us to open up the can of worms to ask all these questions again. But for Canada, it was essentially a World Cup qualifier. And it, because of the way it's set up, they actually have to kind of win over two legs. They have to get a draw, I think, in Orlando in November to advance to the hex. If they don't get a draw in that match, if they get a draw, they should be fine, because they'll go through to the knockout round, championship phase of the Nations League, and that should get them more points in the FIFA ranking if they play Mexico or somebody like that. But they need to get another result against the U.S., I think, and then just play Mexico, because that one, if they beat them, then they'll be fine. If they lose to them, they probably will get more points because they're going to play Mexico. But it was like a World Cup qualifier for them, so we have to remember that. Whereas for the U.S., it was not.
Neil Blackman joins us, and Neil, I just want to get your thoughts, obviously. I mean, what we've witnessed so far in 2 years of this national team program, we have witnessed, future players coming in, obviously some players injured, you know, they can't perform at the moment. Christian Pulisic is supposed to be the top dog of this entire setup. Yet, you know, we have questionable results where, okay, you could put seven past Cuba, but you can't have a performance or quality performance against a team like Mexico under Tata Martino, who has improved tremendously, in my opinion. And now you take for granted against Canada that were rip-roaring, ready to go, and wanted to have a performance against the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously frustrating, and I think we saw that from the fan base this week, and we saw, I thought, a quality response by the bulk of the U.S. soccer media this week in kind of interrogating Greg Berhalter's, tactical rigidity and sort of the the lack of a plan B when the system tactical game plan doesn't work. And you know, I think what was frustrating about it most of all was probably two things, just about the game, not about really where the Federation is, where the Vince program is, but in terms of the Canada game, you know, and I think Kardik addressed some of this. I thought the two biggest frustrating things were, one, it wasn't like what John Herdman did was complicated. The book's kind of out on the U.S. now. You know, if you can flood the midfield with numbers and make the U.S. adjust to that, thus far, Greg Berhalter has not done that. And this is not like an obvious tactical – this is not a complicated tactical thing. I mean, you move numbers into the midfield and even up those matchups. The U.S. did not do that. They did not do that against Canada. They did not do that against Uruguay. They did not do that against Mexico. So you're really left with one game, Chile, where the U.S. had made a substantive tactical adjustment that was effective in the last few months. So I think that was frustrating thing one, is that it's not like this is complicated. Frustrating thing two, and maybe the more important one, which Kardik spoke to a little bit, is not so much, you know, I'm not going to speak to the arrogance. What I will speak to is the problem of losing this type of game, which, you know, you can talk about the way Canada emphasizes it all you want and how it might have meant more to them, but it shouldn't have. This is a road qualifier. The reason that the United States did not qualify for the World Cup in Russia at its very core was they struggled to accumulate road points. This is not a hostile venue. This is not if Canada gets into the hex, in many ways that would be fortuitous because it would eliminate a hostile venue. This is BMO Field, an MLS stadium that a lot of these players have played at. It's a beautiful pitch. It wasn't a sellout. This shouldn't have been hard. And the U.S. Just went out and didn't perform. I thought it was, you know, I tweeted it was the second worst performance by an international team in a competitive match I've ever seen. I'm receding from that a little bit. I would say it's third because I've decided I think that the Costa Rica qualifier last cycle was worse than the one in San Jose. But still, to be one of the three worst World Cup performances or one of the three worst competitive match performances in the modern era of the Federation, certainly since I've been covering it, speaks to the length that this team has to go with World Cup qualifying now a year away.
Robert, you know, we've been watching this game, this national team, for a very long time, and how much are the alarm bells ringing all over our nation? But apparently it feels like the alarm bells have been either on silent, or if it is ringing, you can't hear the noise, because the U.S. Soccer Federation is still on, you know, there's nothing to see here. You know, please disperse. We don't need no stinking badges. Or the dog in the room, in his living room, and the entire room is on fire. It's not so bad. Go ahead, Robert. I mean, what's the feeling?
I think the best analogy is the one you hit on, which is the dog analogy. Those of us who own dogs or have owned dogs know the scenario where the dog barks at seemingly random things or ghosts or whatever, and you just, you know, especially in the middle of the night, you just eventually just keep telling the dog to be quiet, go to bed, be quiet, go to bed, and someone could be breaking into your house and you just don't care because all you hear is the dog barking and not even thinking about why. And I think that's kind of what this situation is for the U.S. national team. I mean, the warning signs are all out there. I mean, I think anybody that follows the team a little bit has seen it and identified it. I mean, it's the lack of transparent process in terms of picking a head coach, a lack of process, period, in picking a structure for not only who's going to lead the men's and women's team, but who's going to be in charge of the technical side of the men's and women's team, who's going to be in charge of the youth side of the men's and women's team, who's reporting to whom, et cetera, et cetera. We've been hearing and should be hearing the warning bells about youth soccer in this country from the U eight level on up to the senior level and some of the struggles we've had on both men's and women's side. I know we're talking about the men's team, but we'd be remiss if we didn't say that some of these problems bleed over into the women's side and will eventually bite us. I mean, these things are all out there, and it seems like it takes a shock result or a seemingly shock result to get people to pay attention. I think the interesting thing for me is Neil and Carter hit on a lot of the points, and I agree with them. But I always find it interesting what information comes out after results like this. And I just want to say I am thankful that I did not watch the match live. I had another sporting event that was occupying my attention, and so I was not I did not have the pleasure of being this shock state like so many other U.S. national team fans did. I got to go back and review it after the fact. But it always interests me that little tidbits of information come out after these kind of results, such as, you know, the interview process for – and I regret that I don't remember who said it. It might have been Grant Wall. It might have been somebody else. You know, mentioned the actual names of the two candidates for the head coaching job, and there was rumors about why. And it's interesting that these things are coming out now, and I don't believe in coincidences. So it sounds like even at the federation level, there's some circling going on and some watching their backs and some dissension in terms of the where things are going, and that can't make any U.S. national team fan feel well. I mean, the end result of this match was – It was fairly obvious what was going to happen. I read a Sports Illustrated article just the other day, going back, you know, thinking about this match, and it's like, you know, what did we miss? And it basically, the Sports Illustrated article laid out the entire game plan for Canada, why they were motivated, you know, what the U.S. had to watch out for, and lo and behold, it's exactly what happened. So I think the thing that should be most frustrating for the U.S. fans is not who the manager is or who the players were on the field, but was the fact that we can't even react to what should have been, as Cardiff and Neil said, the most obvious game plan, and what basically this match was laid out in front of you, and how do you respond? And the response was just falling flat on your face, and what is one of the most beautiful cities in North America. So I think that should be the most frustrating thing for U.S. fans right now is, you know, at the end of the day, we can't even, you know, take care of the easy ones. I mean, Canada is not an easy team. But this setup was, you know, made fairly easier for the U.S. because we knew what was coming and we were in an ideal situation to adapt to it, and didn't do that. So, I mean, this has been going on, and it's going to continue going on for a while, I fear.
So here's the bigger question I have now. And, you know, I would like – I think a simple answer is this. Because – you had Dave Sarokin as the interim head coach of this national team. And the truth is that the coaching search should have began a long, long time ago. Because once you got last year, September, October, November, once you get to those 3 months, at the end of a World Cup, the coaching search should have been done a long time ago, starting in January, February of 2018, while Dave Sarokin runs these kids into these big-time friendlies or, you know, whatever friendlies they're going to be playing against, and then you look for your next head coach, which is what they did not do.
Yeah.
Because when September begins, after a World Cup, that's when a new cycle begins. And to me, gentlemen, the way it looked like, in my opinion, and the way that Greg Berhalter got hired without even a challenge of a proper coaching search, to me, whether it's Carlos Cordero, Ernie Stewart, and I like Ernie Stewart, but you know what? I feel like he's been thrown into a situation that I don't know what he's trying to do. But the truth of the matter is this: there should be no such thing as a general manager of a national team. A national team, Kartik Krishnire, is not a club team. And the way that the board is, and the way that this board has been acting, treating this whole situation, including the hiring of Carlos Cordero as president of U.S. Soccer Federation, the highest governing body of the sport in this country. They have acted more like a club than a national team. That is my concern. That is my fear. And right now, it's beginning to show. Go ahead, Kardik.
Yeah, absolutely, Daniel. I agree with that. They've actually acted more like a governing clique, a small governing clique that's going to promote people within their clique, regardless of result, and not implement any level of accountability within it. So you said September of 2018. I'm anticipating Neil's going to agree with me on this. We're talking about, you knew Bruce Arena was only managing you through the World Cup. So if you qualified for the World Cup, yes, he would be managing you in June and hopefully July of 2018 if you made the knockout stages. But you knew in September you needed a new manager. You knew this in October of 2018, even before you, or 2017, excuse me, before you crashed out of qualifying. Then there were all kinds of little complications. We get eliminated from qualifying, and you're thinking, okay, Dave Sarokin is going to come in and take the November friendly. Oh, no, sorry. First off, we're going to have an interim coach take the November friendly, which ended up being against Portugal. We all thought, and you know, Robert and Neil, correct me if I'm wrong, we all thought it might be Tab Roberts that took that job. That was logical. But it seems now in hindsight, and I remember being shocked on the phone with Sunil Gulati the next day in that press conference call he did, when he didn't name Tab the interim. And I thought, you know what, that's strange. Maybe it's because of something going on with the U-20s. They'll name Tab in a week. Instead, they named Sarokin, because I don't think they wanted Tab Ramos to have a foot in the door to get the job, because they had a preordained result already with who they wanted to get the job. Now, in hindsight, all this stuff now becomes very clear, all these strange things that happened. Then, because Jill Ellis was kind of struggling with the women's team, there was talk she was going to get the sack, and Laura Harvey, who had just quit as the Reign head coach, and the England job was open at the time, and actually John Herdman, ironically enough, was the other candidate for that England job that ended up going to Phil Neville. The thought was, oh gosh, the Federation's concerned about that, so they're just going to let Sarokin stay for a while. Well, as it turns out, Jill Ellis didn't get sacked. She ended up winning another World Cup. She's now gone into the record books as an absolute legend management-wise. But that then puts the decision off for a few more months. Then we had this USSF election, and Sunil said, well, it wouldn't be fair if I appointed someone, let my successor handle that. So then we wait a couple more months. Then Cordero comes in, and it becomes, oh, you know what? We need to hire a general manager. And again, Daniel, I don't understand the whole idea of having a general manager for a national team program. It's quite an odd thing. I mean, you could have a technical director, but the general manager is just another layer of maybe it was just another stalling tactic and another opportunity to give a job to someone who U.S. Soccer wanted to take care of. So then we wait a couple more months. And in that period, we're thinking, this is getting ridiculous, but maybe they're doing a thorough search. Maybe Peter Vermees will get interviewed, a top coach in Major League Soccer with a clear playing style. No, Vermees was told, according to my sources, was told by Dan Quinn after a Sporting Kansas City match, hey, you know, you're not the guy. Then we thought maybe it would be Jesse Marsh, who was my favorite, and as I think everybody who follows me on Twitter knows, I was championing at the time. Then word got out to some of us that, well, Jesse's a little too controversial, right, for the Federation. They don't like a guy that's opinionated as him. So you cross him off. Maybe it might be Juan Carlos Osorio. He ends up getting hired by someone else, even though I think he might have been waiting around for the U.S. job. And this goes on and on and on until the interview two candidates, one of which is the guy they seem to have preordained the job for. The other one, Oscar Perea, I think was interviewed just to cover their tracks. And then it looks like Julian Lopetegui, according to Grant Wall, the former Spain manager, the former Real Madrid manager, is interested in the U.S. job. And the U.S. Soccer Federation basically tells us, even a month before Berhalter is formally hired, that, well, we're too far along in the process, we can't interview him. We can't reopen the whole process, which I think indicates to all of us, oh, well, they already hired Verhalter. And sure enough, when Columbus this season was over, Verhalter was hired. So I think now in hindsight, Daniel, if you look back at how this whole thing played out, they, in October of 2017, knew who they wanted to hire, but then, oh, and one other event I forgot, and then I'll shut up and let everybody else talk for a minute. When the Columbus Crew potentially moving to Austin came out a week after the Trinidad match. So then you don't want to destabilize that situation further because, again, U.S. Soccer and MLS act as a single entity, right? They're not autonomous organizations. There are these conflicts of interest, which is, I think, a big part of the problem with U.S. Soccer, where there's no top professional league in the world that gets protected by its federation as much as Major League Soccer does by the U.S. Soccer Federation. I think at that point they decided, oh, we cannot bring Verhalter on board now because of the Columbus situation, so we got to wait and let it play out. And the idea that the U.S. Soccer would wait till the end of an MLS season to actually put someone in the head coaching role, to me, just tells you who's actually calling the shots here. It is Soccer United Marketing and Don Garber.
And that's the shame of it, isn't it? That's the shame of it. Because here's the thing. If Don Garber wants to call the shots, with U.S. Soccer Federation, Neil, then he basically should have just gave up as commissioner of the league. And instead of wasting everybody's time in hiring Carlos Cordero as basically a puppet, which I don't want to say it, but we're going to have to say it because it's true, then Don Garber should have put his name on the ballot as new president of the U.S. Soccer Federation. Because if this is the case that some and Don Garber is running and calling the shots, well, there's a problem here because a federation should not be led by a league. They are the governing body that runs the game in this country. And Carlos Cordero should not be the one that has his strings attached to his arms and legs and, of course, the hand up his back to open his mouth. Mr. Blackman.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, mistakes were made, right? Mistakes were made. The thing that kills me about all of it is, Karnick touched on a lot of the process pieces without mentioning the kind of elephant in the room that the guy who's likely to take over as the chief executive behind Cordero is Jay Verhalter, who's the brother of the national team coach, who was hired through this kind of inauspicious, not transparent process. But the timing of the thing, I just keep coming back to the football piece. And to me, the football piece of it is the U.S. caps off what I consider to be the most colossal failure in American sport in at least two decades, by not qualifying for the World Cup. And they're left with this opportunity to start the new cycle. Really, October 11th, 2017 is when the cycle should have started. Or at the latest after the Portugal friendly that we kind of all assumed on the media call that Dave Sarashin would manage, and that would be it. That they'd bring in a new manager and give him camp cupcake, what we traditionally call that, to work out a new team. That's not what happened. Instead, Dave Sarashin, I thought, rather admirably capped a lot of kids. But look, that is the problem with that is they hired Greg Berhalter to bring in a system. They hired him to play a particular style of soccer that was intended to bridge the gap from the gritty, we're going to grind it out, we'll punch above our weight teams that Karnick referenced, to a combination of that grit, which was lost under Jurgen Klinsmann, and certainly in the second cycle, and something that tactically could help the U.S. play confidently and competently against the best sides in the world. So he was supposed to bridge that gap, and that's why you bring in a system manager who's an ideologue like Greg Berhalter. That's why you shirk pragmatism. But if you're going to do that, then you don't waste a year of repetition with an interim manager who's an extension of the staff that has orchestrated the most colossal failure in the history of the Federation. And I know Karnik will want to defend Bruce Arena now, and that's fine. He can do that. He's wrong. But we can debate it all we want. Whatever you think of Arena, having one of his lieutenants handle a year of repetitions for the team and generation that was to take their place, when what you really want to do is install a system, is ludicrous. It's ludicrous. And you're seeing how ridiculous it is now, because 9 months in, the system should be working. Berhalter's excuse is process, process, process. And now we're starting to ask, whoa, is that process even working? And we're asking that question a year too late.
Robert, Greg Berhalter, and, you know, we program to go forward and to prove to every American soccer fan that what he is trying to do is working for our players. But as we've seen, it's not working because either we don't have the players for his system, or he's just not throwing the kitchen sink out there. He just keeps on saying process, process, process. And meanwhile, as Neil, said earlier, the process is not working. I mean, are we supposed to have a national team that's supposed to play like Barcelona? I mean, I find that weird to see a national team that, only gets together for about over a week to 10, 12 days because you have to train with each other. You have two games in the span of 5 days. You got friendlies. You've got, World Cup qualifiers. You got to have, quick, cohesive chemistry with one another, because the truth is you play your best when you play with your club mates in a league. This is a national team. This is not a Gold Cup. This is not a European Cup. This is not a World Cup where you have a couple of weeks to up to maybe a month and a half if you're lucky enough to go from the first group stage match to the final and hopefully win the damn thing. You have basically two games within a span of 5 days, Robert, to get the results you need just so you can qualify for a World Cup.
So I'm going to apologize now, because I'm going to I'm going to fall back on my day job with what I'm going to say next. And if I get a little too esoteric or whatever, I apologize to the listeners.
I'll pull up the
card on you. But let me take issue with your thesis here. Why isn't the point of Greg Berhalter's job to make the World Cup or a certain level of the World Cup? Why isn't Greg Berhalter's job to prepare the senior team to be competitive for the World Cup in 2026? Why is it Greg Berhalter's job to create this system for success for the U.S. men's national team? And I think that's part of the issue we have with the Federation. I mean, it's just a mess of competing goals and interests. There's a number of reasons for that. We can get into tax status. We can get into corporate setup. We could get into, the general manager versus non-general manager. But at the end of the day, what's the vision for this federation? Is it to make this a soccer nation? Is it to win the World Cup on the men's side? Is it to, as you said, Daniel, is it to create a style of play? Because what I see is a number of parts of on the men's side, a number of parts that are working seemingly towards the same goal, but not really. Because you know, on the youth side, we have the various youth teams that have seemingly their own goals, and they're supposed to qualify for the Olympics or the Youth World Cups. And I know we've talked in the past about the value of the Youth World Cups. Are they really that valuable? You know, is the Olympics more valuable? Is the goal to develop that talent to push it up to the senior level? You know, or is it to go out and to vet as much young talent as possible? You know, maybe it's maybe you're relying on a larger pool of players and going out and bringing in players left and right to see who, you know, can feed into the larger senior team. You know, but then on the other hand, you have this men's team that hires these coaches with its own process that doesn't feed into the system of the seemingly of the lower sided teams or the youth team, excuse me. There's a number of competing interests here. There's not one cohesive goal for this federation. And say what you want about other federations. Germany has had books written about the goal that it has for its federation and its soccer, for example. This U.S. federation has no clue what it wants. It can tell you what it wants. It tells you it wants to win a World Cup in 8 years, whatever. But they're not putting anything towards that goal. They're not really coming up with a cohesive, down-the-line plan for the men's team to do that. And I know that's easier said than done, but are the goals for Greg Berhalter the same as they are for Todd Ramos? Are they, do they, the goals match each other at the same time? And do they match, as we've said, MLS and the other domestic leagues? And do they need to? And I think we've definitively said no, they don't really need to. Especially if you want to see success, you're going to have to compete against each other at times. So I think ultimately the problem with this federation is they don't know what they want. They say they know what they want, and I think they know what they want, but they don't know what they want and how to get there. And I think that's why you see the results that we're seeing. That's why you see the processes that we're seeing. I wouldn't be shocked if when they hired Bruce Arena, and I'm on Neil's side on this one, that was one of the biggest debacles ever, but I wouldn't be surprised if they sat there and went, you know what, maybe we can keep him for another cycle. Or if he doesn't want to stay around for another cycle, he makes the World Cup and he can self-pick a successor. And then when he bombs out spectacularly, you can't go on that plan because of the obvious optics. And so they go for another bad optics of not having a hiring process and stringing this out. All of this feeds into this idea that this federation doesn't know what it's doing. I mean, at the end of the day, they don't know what they're doing. They're just trying to CYA and to get to these goals that they set for themselves, but without a process to do it. And in any business and in any nonprofit organization, anything like that, when you come up with these goals, when you come up with goals, lofty goals, and you don't work together with a process to reach those goals, it's going to blow up in your face. And that's what we're seeing, you know, with the U.S. Soccer Federation right now.
Kardik, you know, it's nice to have goals to set up for yourself and, you know, try to go forward and, you know, meet those expectations. But those goals won't be met if we're going to have a national team that just can't seem to get up for an opponent that is, you know, look, they're much tougher and more determined than a nation like Cuba that we still don't know about these players, but the only thing we know is whenever they come to play the United States, either in a World Cup qualifier or an Olympic qualifier or a youth national team qualifier tournament for the Youth World Cups or even a Gold Cup, you usually got to go to Vegas to put down how many players are going to defect to be in the United States permanently and play you know, professional soccer in their dreams. Because, you know, putting seven past Cuba is not a difficult thing to do because Cuba is still not that good soccer-wise. Yet Canada, who has something to prove and wants to prove it to not just to themselves and to their fans and prove it against the United States, also proving it in the region and in world football that, hey, we want to make some noise and we feel that we are going to be ready for this U.S. team and we're going to take them out.
Yeah. So to Robert's point, I think this is very – he raised something very important because I think if you had a federation, a nonprofit that has at least ostensibly, because again, they haven't stated their goals, but ostensibly the goal of making the sport more accessible more popular and more successful in the United States at the men's and women's level and at the boys and girls level. You wouldn't have a governing body that is consistently being sued by member leagues, by match promoters, by their own women's national team players, by their own former nonprofit foundation, charitable foundation, and by some of the youth clubs in that are governed by U.S. soccer. Okay? There is an arrogance, a sloppiness, and a insularity in almost everything U.S. soccer does. And it reached a tipping point some time ago at to where the floodgates opened, and now you have, whether it's Crossfire Premier and the DeAndre Yedlin case, and then U.S. soccer's response to that is to relegate the team, the club that produced DeAndre Yedlin, from League A in their development academy. Okay, so, I mean, then there's NASL, right? Their response to NASL is to de-sanction the league. And regardless of what you think of NASL or Crossfire Premier and Solidarity Payment or the U.S. Women's Equal Pay lawsuit or the fact that they're playing so many more matches on turf than the men, or regardless of what you think of relevant sports and you think that there should be a match between Villarreal and Atletico Madrid in Miami, a La Liga match. I happen to think there shouldn't be, so I'm actually on U.S. soccer side with that one. Or regardless of what you think about U.S. soccer having the right to cut off the arm of their charitable arm, their charitable organization, and create something internally, something new internal, irrespective of your views of all of this, Daniel, the sloppiness and the arrogance in which all of this stuff took place now has exposed them to horrible legal danger, because in the process of doing what they did that opened themselves up to legal exposure, they have been exceedingly sloppy in how they handle it. So let's get back to the men's national team. The same sloppiness we see in how U.S. soccer governs the sport, which has opened the door for aggrieved parties to sue them and to tie up the court system and the FIFA dispute resolution chamber and the Court of Arbitration on Sports, to tie up all of these judicial bodies with lawsuits or claims or complaints about U.S. soccer. That same sloppiness has led the U.S. Soccer Federation into a position where they are equally sloppy in the process and the way they represent processes publicly to handling of the men's national team. So I think U.S. soccer started with a very arrogant position. Neil, when you started covering the national team, which is a little bit after I did, their view was basically, we are soccer in the United States. We're the ones who are bringing this game to you. The national team is like your club team. And at the time, MLS had 10 teams, 12 teams. USL had teams coming and going every year. NASL hadn't formed yet. And, yeah, a lot of us did see U.S. And the Premier League wasn't on NBC, and the Bundesliga wasn't on Fox. So it was what we had. So they had that perspective then. And I think they still have that perspective now. I think they have this perspective. You need us more than we need you. Even though Atlanta United is far more popular than the U.S. men's national team today. There wasn't a situation where there was a team in the United States back with Alex Adams, and out on both television and in a stadium 15 years ago when we started with this thing. With guys like Neil and I started, and Daniel, you started around the same time. That mm-hmm. wasn't the case at the time. So I think they're still living in that world. And everything they have done, which has exposed them to all these lawsuits and to the sloppiness in the selection process or the search or whatever you want to call it, which landed Greg Berhalter as our U.S. men's national team manager or head coach, whatever terminology they're using now, is due to the sloppiness and the arrogance that comes from the insularity. So all of the things I pointed out and Neil pointed out about the process and the search and Bruce Arena and then Dave Sarokin goes back to that insular sloppiness, that insularity, that feeling that they are on a pedestal. Everybody is thankful to them. Everybody should be grateful to them. And if you're not grateful for them, to them for providing football to us, soccer to us, then, you know, you're not really part of the U.S. soccer culture. So forget you. That is what led to all this legal exposure, and that is also why they continue to make so many errors in how they manage this U.S. fan castle. I think they're completely tone deaf. I think they do not have a clear understanding of what has happened in terms of the growth of the sport in this country, and the professional club game, and interest in leagues in Europe over the course of the last 10 years. So they basically are coming from a point of view that whatever we decide in our small little group, whatever we do in our small little group, will yield results where people will buy tickets, regardless of how high the ticket prices are, and will watch the games on television, regardless of the level of play or the type of play. When in fact, that is not the case anymore. I point to Atlanta United. That's a very clear example of a shift in this country. But it probably started when Seattle jumped from USL to MLS. That was probably, and that happened the same year that we reached the Confederations Cup final, which was the high water mark program. It's been downhill since for the national team game, you know, with some, you know, great moments, 2010, obviously the 14 World Cup, uphill, you know, but we haven't won an A level Gold Cup since 2007. On the flip side, the club game in this country's grown, and then you have NBC 2013 grabbing the Premier League rights, making the Premier League. Premier League, like it's the NFL or the NBA, the way they cover it. And I think U.S. soccer just doesn't understand or have a clear grasp of where the program is and where the fan base is and where soccer is in this country relative to the world they grew up in.
Neil, when I go to social media, whether it's Twitter or Facebook, and I'm reading from tweets from U.S. soccer fans, forget the whole pro-rel situation, because right now our federation is in a place where I feel like it's dropping to brand new lows. When you're seeing U.S. soccer fans tweeting, I'm happy that Jesse Marsh is doing well at Red Bull Salzburg. He should not even bother being the next head coach of the U.S. men's national team. He should concentrate on his own situation. Seeing, you know, people talking about, you know, they're happy that U.S. soccer didn't get Tab Ramos, that they didn't get Tata Martino, or they didn't get Peter Vermees from Sporting Kansas City. To say that these people should just not bother and poison themselves with the U.S. Soccer Federation, how does that make you feel when, you know, these men, and let me just say this for the record, you know, I've covered Jesse Marsh for the New York Red Bulls, and he basically reinvented himself when he took over in 2015 as the head coach of this club after Mike Petke got sacked. This man basically just reinvented himself, got his players to believe in what he wants to do, integrated these players from the Red Bulls Academy, from their, at the time, PDL, now USL League 2, USL Championship League side, into the MLS club, getting the Red Bulls deep into the CONCACAF Champions League in 2018, sadly losing the eventual champions in Guadalajara, yet he cannot be the national team head coach because he's over-opinionated, and now every single American soccer fan says, Jesse, stay in Europe. You don't want to come back home. How does that make you feel, Neil?
Well, I mean, I think it speaks to the insularity that Karnak's talking about. It speaks to the fact that you can't have a plan if not everybody is pulling in the same direction and no one can really articulate what it is that Robert was talking about. you know, from a pro, and you know this from all the work you do covering New York, but I mean, look, this is a Bob Bradley disciple. The animosity between Bob and the Federation is not well. It's not a huge secret, right? Like, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a big secret that Bob Bradley feels wronged to some extent. I think with justice by the Federation, and I think his acolytes, the most famous and effective of which thus far is Jesse Marsh, probably had their ideas and had a specific set of demands that they would have. And I don't think U.S. Soccer has the wherewithal, or is not, you know, I don't think they have the wherewithal to meet them right now. They are too insular. And you know, the other interesting thing that kind of expands or expounds upon that point that Kartik makes is, you know, when you look at the number of lawsuits that do exist, to give you an idea of what's going on with the Federation, you know, you forget that one of them is actually a lawsuit or a series of complaints against Jay Bearhalter for the type of culture that there is at Soccer House, that kind of toxic workplace culture. That's a piece of it. And then, you know, what should be the most glaring piece is that the one piece of U.S. soccer that has a consistent culture of excellence is the women's program. And what's going on? Multiple lawsuits. We got a not particularly transparent coaching search, and a significant risk that the next hire is somebody that doesn't understand or have enough connections to college soccer, which for all the complaints that it gets sometimes, I think anyone that follows the women's game understands that it still remains an immense competitive advantage for the United States. And to put the person in charge of the women's program, to put a person in charge of it that doesn't have familiarity and intimate familiarity with the collegiate game is a disaster. But that's how insular they are, that the literal shining light they have for the world, they still can't seem to do right by.
Yep. They just can't. I mean, Robert, I've never seen such ineptitude from a federation. And I mean, look, there are plenty of federations all over the world. You know, they do a poor job. They do a fantastic job. When they get to that, you know, desperation mode, that you get to that last day of World Cup qualifying, regardless if it's in UEFA, CONMEBOL, Asia, Africa, even Oceania, if it ever gets to that level, where you need that last day to get a result, whether it be a draw or a win, against an opponent where they either need to qualify themselves or are looking to play spoiler to knock you off from qualifying in a World Cup. And and they don't have it. And we're talking about what happened, of course, in Kovu and down in Trinidad. What happened with Italy? You never thought you'd ever see Italy get eliminated from World Cup qualifying because they always qualify for the World Cup. I mean, back in 94, the English never qualified for the World Cup, and that was the lowest point in their history up until this past World Cup in Russia in 2018, where they actually did well and they advanced strong, sadly losing, I believe, in the quarterfinals or the semifinals of the World Cup. But still, though, we've come to a point where Italy will always find someone new and put the program back on track, and it's going to be, oh, it's just like it was before they didn't qualify for Russia. We're back on track. Everything's fine. Here, it just feels like they haven't woken up or they're still in a drunken stupor because we're still feeling like we're not doing the job that this federation is supposed to do.
Right. So two countries that didn't make the World Cup the same year that the U.S. did, Italy, who you mentioned, and the Netherlands. Let's take a quick look at how those two nations reacted to not making the World Cup. And arguably those two have a bigger – I mean, it's a crisis, a bigger crisis when they don't, even bigger than the U.S. What does Italy do? Well, I mean, right now they're in a known quantity with their manager, you know, Roberto Mancini, somebody that's not new. But if you looked at the Italian team and their youth setup, there was certainly a lot of questions about how competitive Italy would be, not only if they had qualified for the World Cup, but in future years, because there was a certainly an aging core to that team. And, you know, to their credit, after that failure, there was resignations, mass resignations. There was a recognition almost, I mean, not immediately, because there wasn't like day of resignations across the board, but within a short period of time, there were resignations at all levels of leadership. And this idea of, okay, what we have done obviously has not failed. It has run its course. Let's go back to it. Then you look at the Netherlands and you say, okay, failed to make the World Cup. They have had hit a lull in player development. They had a great generation that has cycled out. Now we need to go in and we need to bring up all of this incredible young talent. We have a great club in Ajax, which is helping develop talent, you know, nearby. We've got, you know, youth players all over the continent. And, oh, by the way, we're going to continue to keep looking for the best talent, even if they are dual, you know, eligible, like, say, a player who's eligible for the U.S. We're going to go chase after those players, because it's not enough to say that we have one or two clubs and this core set of players that are going to form the basis of our national team for years to come. We're going to keep chasing players and keep chasing talent and keep competing. And so you compare that to what the United States did after they didn't qualify for the World Cup, which is, you know, no mass resignations. There was changes in leadership, but it was through the usual process. There was, you know, no falling on the sword, except for kind of Bruce Arena, but not really. There was this elevation of the new golden generation before they had proven everything. And, you know, that generation of players that core group of players that they've highlighted are going through understandable. Some of them are going through understandable struggles. Some are, you know, still finding their way, and some are succeeding. And they're doing what young players do, which is develop, some for the better and some for the worse. And yeah, I think that, you know, I think that just speaks so ill of what we've talked about tonight, is the fact that when it comes down to it, everything we've said comes down to the fact that the U.S. can't admit, the U.S. Federation, Soccer Federation leadership can't admit that it messed up, and it can't
no.
go. You can't go from there until you can admit that you messed up.
That is so true.
Yep. No, it's very true. It's very true. They can't admit that they made a mistake. They can't make. They are still making mistakes. And speaking about the dual, and speaking about the dual nationality players, I want to get to that for a second here, gentlemen.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter where you come from in this country or where your parents originally came from. Look, obviously with Kartik, his family came originally from India. My parents came from Romania at the time under communism. And, of course, after the Second World War, you know, my parents met in here in the United States, you know, when my grandparents, but for both of my parents, you know, they left Romania at the time to live a better life. They went to Italy for a year, and then they flew to the United States separately, and they met in New York City. You know, they wanted a better life and everything. But when you see either coaches or youth coaches like Tab Ramos, who is such a decorated American national team player, like what Hugo Perez, a decorated national team player, these two men got results in youth soccer. For Tab Ramos, he got the results with the under-20s and CONCACAF Youth World Cup qualifying, the World Cup itself, three consecutive tournaments in the under-20 World Cup to get to the quarterfinals. That's unheard of. Hugo Perez, who has been a legend with our American American national team, developing young players that are, you know, their parents are from Spanish-speaking nations, but they come to the United States to have a better life, and they're performing at a high level through Hugo Perez. What do they say to these two players, Kartik? Tab, you're not getting the head coaching job for the senior team. Hugo Perez, he gets ignored. Where does he go? He gets a job with the FMF to be a scout. How disgraceful is it that these two men regardless if they can speak Spanish or not, because they've done so much good in the United States that they are ignored and not even bothering to be, you know, truly a part of this federation, and it's a shame.
Yeah, I think one of the mistakes in my lifetime, one of the things that still bothers me is that Bob Gansler didn't take Hugo Perez to the 1990 World Cup, nor did he take a number of other really good players who were playing indoor soccer in this country at the time, because he felt he had to be playing outdoors. Why is it such a young team? Although that young team developed the likes of Eric Winalda's and the Tab Ramos for us. But I had a lot of fun with Hugo Perez. I was dumbfounded, really, by U.S. soccer's unwillingness or inability to engage him. And very sad when he took the job with the SMF, although he should do that, because clearly U.S. soccer, they have this task force they set up. Mike Brasilia from Soccer America reported that of the 54 members of the task force, I think they have one of the task forces, they have one Latino on there. So that's a tragedy in itself. I want to pivot for a moment. I'm glad you brought up the issue of school maps, because I know Neil and I both want to talk about this. The decision by Greg Berhalter to not even entertain the idea of recalling Fabian Johnson, not seem to have any interest in tracking Timothy Chandler. Jimmy Chandler, and not even considering Julian Green, who, by the way, played very well under Dave Sarachan. I mean, if there's one takeaway from the Sarachan era, one positive takeaway from that year that he was in the job, when he should have only been in the job however long, you know, one friendly game, it was that he got the best out of Julian Green. It's the best Julian Green ever looked in the U.S. shirt with under Sarachan. Playing to his strength, Green's strength as a wide player that could cut inside. For whatever reason, there seems to have been a decision made by Greg Berhalter and perhaps his higher ups that they weren't going to call in certain veteran German-American players, players who were playing at a very high level in the Bundesliga. In the case of Fabian Johnson, at times last season, the best American in a league filled with good American players. I know I've gotten off topic here, but it's incredulous to me. Fabian has communicated with the extra coming, and Neil, I think, will tell you in a minute. He has made it very clear he's available for selection. He's made it very clear he would like to be part of the change with the national team. There is no argument that can be made that there are 20 field players eligible for the U.S. men's national team at this moment that are better than Bobby and Johnson. And you cannot make that argument. And I'm angry about this. Sorry. I'm losing my my cool on this. You cannot make the argument that just go down the list of people who were selected for the World Cup or who've been selected for this nation's league against Canada. You cannot make the argument that all 20 of those field players are better than Bobby and Johnson, particularly when Bobby Johnson is a player that can play in four or five different roles, plug a lot of holes, and give you some leadership in that revenue. Leadership that is sorely lacking in this program. So, I'd like to know why Bobby Johnson is not being called in, why he's not being talked about, why he is just forgotten by this national program at a time when the program is at its lowest point in 30 years. It's not like, oh, well, we moved on because we have so many great young players and we're getting these outstanding results, and it's part of the process. Look at how well our guys are doing. No, you're at your lowest point in 30 years and you don't call in one of your three or four best players ever? I don't get it.
Neil, it's terrible what we're watching here. I mean, look, I always believe in the American player. I believe that we do have talented players. Josh Sargent is talented. Tim Weah is talented. You know, Christian Pulisic, in my book, is probably, you know, I'm not saying he's the next coming of Landon Donovan, but he has ability to change a game, you know, in a heartbeat. And as of right, and even Josh Sargent has the ability to go out and do some damage. But right now, I just don't feel like Greg Berhalter is the right man for the right job right now. I don't want to say it, but the truth is it's looking pretty evident that he's not, because he's trying. I don't know if he's trying to make adjustments. I don't know if he's trying to go out there and to, you know, get people to understand what he's trying to do. Either we don't have the players for this system, or he's not the guy that we thought he was supposed to be to make this national team better.
Yeah, I mean, look, first on Fabian. Fabian's had conversations with the Yanks are coming, and Fabian would have played the Gold Cup, would be happy to be involved in qualifying. Still, loves his country, played out of position for his country well at a World Cup, played out of position for his country well at other times in qualifying, not as much in the Hex, certainly in a Copa America. The guy is a pretty good player. Top 10 among Bundesliga wingers in chance creation last season, I believe, for the third time in his career. Is he towards the end of his career now where he's more of a 30-minute role player? Probably. That doesn't mean that he doesn't have something to offer with the national team. So when Fabian said, I want to be called in for the big games, what he meant was, and I can tell you this is fact. What he meant was, please don't call me to play political friendlies in Havana. That's what he meant. So there's some fun breaking news on that. Berhalter. The goal to implement a system and a way of playing that makes the U.S. difficult to play against and combines the traditional grit and hustle of the U.S. soccer program with a build out of the back possession style of football. That is a noble goal. It is a noble goal. It is probably a goal that does something along the lines of what Robert is talking about, which gets you on a path to how do we win a World Cup in 2026 when we host? Or how do we not lose to Mexico in a semifinal? I think that's noble. How long do you wait before you question whether or not Greg Berhalter is the guy to implement a system? And secondly, and more importantly in my opinion, and I'm really interested in the guy's opinion on this, is that the right system? Or should the U.S. with a young group, with a young core that I like, including Tyler Adams, who we haven't talked about, should the U.S. go and hire a manager who is organized defensively and believes in counterattacking football? And can you tell the public that that's okay? Because one thing I think is, as the American viewing public, soccer viewing public expands and begins to understand soccer better, and they go and they start seeking out knowledge in places that American fans didn't seek out knowledge. It's not just Liga MX people that are tactics nerds, right? You've got it all over the place now. Maybe then they'll appreciate counterattacking football a little more, and we can get back to doing what has offered the United States some success.
Yeah, absolutely. Robert, it's just disheartening to see that this federation is – I'm going to have to say it anyway because it just feels like it. It feels rudderless right now. Our federation, the governing body for the game in this country, it feels rudderless. It feels it just feels like the ship is either sinking or you can't keep the masts up and the wind is not catching it to blow it in the right direction. because with a national team coach, you only have a certain amount of days to be with these players coming from either domestic leagues or international leagues, and the majority of them are coming from Germany, yet it's just been really disheartening to see this type of performance happening. And all I can say is that the ship is rudderless, and, you know, who do we blame here? Do we blame it all on Ernie Stewart, who is supposed to be the general manager of this national team? Do we blame it on the president and Carlos Cordero, who was apparently voted in to being to take over for Sunil Gulati? I mean, obviously the head coach will always be on the chopping block or on the firing block, you know, by the supporters and the fans because they feel he's not doing the job. Because yes, this is a results-driven business, and sadly, the results are not coming in the way they should be. Who gets the blame here?
I thought we were supposed to blame Jurgen Klinsmann for everything in U.S. soccer. Did I miss the memo on that one? I thought that was the standard line. Wow, that's a big question because I mean again I think going back to what we have been talking about, we certainly see, and the general public I think certainly sees the ship sinking or taking on water, but. Until there's a recognition at the top that, and maybe there is, maybe I'm not giving them enough credit, but unless there's recognition at the top of the Federation that that this the ship is taking on water, then there can't really be any fundamental change. You know, you can't blame one specific person. I think you can blame a combination of people. You know, I'm going to try not to go down this rabbit hole too much, but if the U.S. Soccer Federation is actually a nonprofit organization, Carlos Cordero probably should not be in the position that he's in. He should probably be a little bit more answerable to a board of directors and not just be president for life. You know, there probably should be some governance changes with the Soccer Federation in order to prevent some of these mistakes that we're seeing. You know, again, we need to go back to what they need to come up with some goals for this federation, for the men's side. You've got a World Cup in 2026 that they're resting all their laurels on. That seemed like a really good opportunity to come up with some goals. I mean, I'll throw this out here. I think Neil threw some really good food for thought out there. And I'm going to put something out there that I don't think is necessarily right, but I'd like to just throw it out there as well. Is does it matter that Greg Berhalter goes past this World Cup cycle? What if the goal for him at this point is to qualify for the World Cup? What if it's to finish in the top two in the group or something like that? If he can achieve that, can we just say, okay, congratulations, thank you, Greg. We're moving on to someone else because we have a new set of goals for the 2026 cycle. Is he a failure if he only lasts one cycle, but he achieves a goal that's set out for him, which is, you know, potentially qualifying for the World Cup, which at this point I think is quite a good enough goal for this team. Do we need to – should the question be instead of is he the right person for this team right now is can he do the job for the next 2 years to qualify for the World Cup, and then we can start thinking about replacing him now. But his goal right now is to make the World Cup, however that is, and we start planning for the future now. You know, is that undercutting him a little bit? Yes. But is that a better strategy at this point than just sitting here saying, you know, is he the right guy? What's our system and everything like that? Again, I'm not saying this is the right question to ask, but I will throw that question out there, which is maybe we have our short-term goal and our long-term goal, which is can Greg do the short-term goal? Can the U.S. qualify for the World Cup? With the way that CONCACAF is set up, yeah, there's still, you know, that path is still certainly there. I mean, that didn't go away with a loss to Canada. But maybe we do start instead of taking everything year by year or cycle, you know, start thinking ahead and say, okay, let's think ahead to 2026 and do what we need to do for this cycle and start getting the men's side more prepared for 2026. I mean, if that is the laurel that you're going to hang your hat on, then maybe everybody works on that. But again, I going back to the original question, you know, there's got to be a fundamental recognition that something's wrong at the top. And that isn't there at this point, even with the lawsuits and even with the high profile failures and everything like that. It's just, there's no system of accountability. And it's interesting, you know, we talk about the Federation taking on water. It was only a few months ago that we had the women's team, which is part of the Federation, just blowing through the World Cup and getting all this press and really highlighting American soccer. And yet we still have all these problems because of the absolutely shambolic governance and leadership on the men's side. It's truly stunning to see the dichotomy between the two sides. But it's interesting to see how you can have one, you know, the same leadership allow or help the women win a World Cup and can't get the men's team right. It's just still staggering to me.
It's very staggering. It's very disheartening. I just don't know what to make of it. I mean, look, eventually one of these days it was bound to happen that we were not going to qualify for a World Cup. The way, though, that it happened was just inexcusable. And now it's becoming more inexcusable because so much time was wasted. So much time was pulled. And, you know, I didn't say it publicly, but at the time I'm thinking to myself, listen, either find someone to become the next head coach of this national team, or just give it to Dave Sakharin. Just let him have it. Give it to him. And Kardik, you're the one that said maybe they should give him the job because he was doing a good job managing these players in these friendlies. I mean, the results he got, you know, in Portugal, in France, I mean, to get draws against two solid nations that have done great things in Europe, in the European Cups, the World Cups themselves. You know, I was thinking to myself, you know, listening to you one time and say, you know what? Give him the job. Just give it to him. Remove the interim tag. Let him have it. We need somebody.
Well,
why is the time being wasted?
Yeah, he certainly did more in his first 6 months on the job than Berhalter has in his first 6 months, right? In terms of restoring some degree of confidence in the American player and in our ability to get results. But the point was, though, of that year under Sarakin, if you weren't going to progress toward playing in that sort of system, and Sarakin set up the U.S. In a lot of those matches to play on the break, and that's why a guy like Julian Green, who I mentioned a little while ago, was so instrumental in that counterattacking strategy. And then the play to the strength of Christian Pulisic and Weston McKennie, which this system currently is not doing. It was pointless in retrospect, because what you did is you once again highlighted that with this, even with the set of young American players, you're probably better off playing that way. And we were going to go in a completely different direction stylistically from where Sarakin was taking us. So, again, that, I think that reflects very poorly on the Federation in retrospect. I did advocate at the time, and Neil remembers, he and I went back and forth on it when I wrote that article thing. And it wasn't because I wanted Sarakin as the manager. I wanted Jesse Marks, as I think everybody knows. But I said, if it wasn't Marks, you interview Osorio, you interview Vermees. I was an anti on Ivan Paca because I didn't want someone to use the American system and didn't know kind of the mentality of American players. So, I guess in that sense, I still feel a little more nativist, maybe in a way, than a lot of the Klinsmann backers were. I think that Klinsmann tried to push the boundaries. I want him for that, but there are certain things inherent in American players. You need to have a man who knows that and understands that. Although Paca maybe did understand that by the time he was done in Atlanta. So I like Marsh. I wanted Osorio if we could get Marsh. For me, my third choice. But Sarakin, I thought, would have been more acceptable continuing the job. He had worked with the young players, then going out and going in a radically different direction, which is what we've done. And getting back to the initial point that Robert made, U.S. soccer, again, has not quantified or articulated what the goal is for Greg Berhalter. In their usual way of not being very transparent about things, they have not identified what the goal is for Berhalter. And he mentioned maybe Carlos Cordero is the wrong guy to govern a nonprofit. I think this goes back to Sunil Gulati, who was very much a law to his own, for good and bad. I mean, there were some times that was quite positive, because Sunil understood the sport and was nimble enough to where he'd say, you know what, it's probably in the best interest of the game in this country if I just do this arbitrarily and not go to my board and work with the professional leagues or whoever to make a decision. But because Sunil became a very strong executive, like you would have in a corporation versus what you would have historically in a nonprofit. And Daniel, I think we did a whole show on this. You had Andrea Canales on with me, and I was getting into the strong executive theory. You know, and that goes back to my political background. The strong executive theory around Sunil Gulati, and I thought that was one of the things U.S. Soccer might have to correct as a nonprofit. I think we did this show right before the election. As it turns out, Cordero hasn't corrected that. Like as Robert mentioned, he's very clearly kind of the same school where decisions are being made arbitrarily. You know, it's a nonprofit, so all the board minutes, there is a certain transparency around board meetings. In fact, I have the book of reports in front of me as we're recording this. That's where we're doing this live show actually. And there's just a lot of stuff that goes on that's not in that book of reports because there are things that never get to the board level. There are things that are never discussed in board meetings. And you know what? It's most of the important decisions that are not discussed in board meetings. So among those is, what is the goal for this U.S. men's national team head coach? Is it to qualify for the 2022 World Cup? Is it to radically change our playing style so we're set up to where we can go deep in the 2026 World Cup, which we will host? Is it to advance to the round of 16 in the 2022 World Cup? Is it to make the hex even if we don't make the World Cup? I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the goal is. So, and it hasn't been articulated, as Robert points out. So we actually don't know what scale, what the expectation level is around Greg Berhalter. We don't know if there's any sort of accountability in this process. And this is radically different than any other confederation in the world. This is radically different than any club job in the world. This is radically different than any head coaching job in an American sport. I mean, I'll just give you this example because they're ranked first or second in the country right now in college football. When Ed Orgeron, who I know, was the interim coach at LSU. He'd been the interim coach at Southern Cal before. When he was handed the LSU job, it was pretty clear what the expectation was. And Neil knows this because he covers SEC football. Within three games, so after he had that interim tag removed, there was talk he was going to get fired. And he's had to consistently win since then to keep his job. That's the thing. I don't know. I don't know what the expectation is. Maybe it's just to make the hack. The U.S. is going to do it because of the rule change. And then he keeps his job. I don't know. So lack of expectations, lack of clarity about the direction of this thing is another big problem. And thank you, Robert, for identifying it.
Yeah, thank you, Robert. Thank you very much. But, you know, Neil, very soon, I mean, I don't know whose heads are going to roll. I mean, I don't know who do you choose to, you know, threaten their jobs at. I don't know who do you have to go to inform people either you fix this or you're going to get sacked. I mean, Jay's not going to fire his brother Greg. Carlos Cordero, we don't even know if he has the ability to fire anybody. I mean, you know, Don Garber, they got a lot of money invested in these games and, where it all goes to and everything. And I just find it ridiculous and silly that we have to wonder who is really, in charge. I mean, you could probably say Ernie Stewart would be gone because, you can claim that, he didn't do his job good enough and whatever you want to say, even though you forced him to come back to be with the U.S. national team and as their general manager, but he was playing his club football, most of his career in the Netherlands. He was running his Dutch club in Breda, NAC Breda, You know, he's doing a lot of things in the Netherlands, and meanwhile, you have all these qualified candidates spurned and upset because, you know, the Federation's not talking to them. You know, who gets the finger of blame pointed at them? That's the big question mark.
I mean, I think it starts with the Athletes Council and whatever their role in shaping U.S. soccer leadership is. I mean, essentially the reason that – not essentially. Cardick would correct me on essentially. The reason that Carlos Cordero is the president of is the Athletes Council voted for him. Had they not done that, then likely Kyle Martino would be the president, and I think things would look substantively different at Soccer House right now. I don't know if you can fire Ernie Stewart when you hired Ernie Stewart and speaking of not articulating goals, I mean, back to Robert's point, we didn't even know what the general manager does until Ernie Stewart had been on the job for 5 months. Like, there was never any, here's what the GM's going to do. That was never established. And now, it's not necessarily clear, but what is clear is that the Federation that is getting sued, Jay Bearhalter takes over. If Jay Bearhalter is the guy who ultimately becomes Dan Flynn, right? If he becomes the Dan Flynn role, then you have a promotion for Ernie Stewart despite a U.S. Federation bids program that has backslid since Cuba, at least in my view, and certainly they haven't done anything but tread water. And he was promoted to be in charge of the women's program, which makes no sense. And you got to hire a women's coach. You know, so and then you got to fend off however many lawsuits it is now. So, I don't know. I don't know how much say MLS would have. What I do know is that, you know, the revenue numbers are bad, attendance numbers are bad, and the longer they lose revenue battles with the USWNT, for example, the longer those sorts of things happen. Ultimately, it might be just losing one of these lawsuits that forces, you know, the first boulders to move in terms of systemic change. But I don't know, like, you know, there's just so much insularity. And like, to Robert and Cardick's point, there's such a willed refusal to admit that they are wrong that it's hard to see any of that happening. So my guess is that what will happen is that the U.S. will not qualify for the World Cup. And then perhaps after two cycles of failure hosting the next World Cup, they might be inclined to make some changes.
We'll see what happens there. I mean, you know, there's still plenty of blame to go around. And it just feels like no one wants to take responsibility for it. Robert, let me throw this at you. Going back to social media, Stu Holden apparently is a part owner of, I believe it's Mallorca in La Liga, and they defeated Real Madrid. And basically what, you know, he goes very happy for this club that done so well and, you know, big match against Real Madrid that they went out and did a job and they got a win. And meanwhile, you know, because Stu Holden is a part of the Athletes Council, and he gets he gets destroyed on Twitter by those who are like, why is it, you know, you're happy about what Mallorca did? Meanwhile, you know, what's going on here in the U.S. that you don't even care about, you know, putting in Cordero as president and all that other fun stuff that they're talking about?
So, you know, I think Stu Holden has plenty of time on the air to talk about a lot of various things. And I, for one, you know, am glad for him that he's a part owner of this club. I mean, A, it's a beautiful part of the world and, you know, allows him to travel to, you know, take beautiful vacations, and B, he gets to be part owner of a professional soccer club, which I think is many of our dream. I think that would be a wonderful thing to be. So I don't fault him for being excited and celebrating and having the opportunity to do this. I mean, he has certainly criticized the Federation, maybe not as much as we and others would have liked. And, you know, he said his piece, and he's certainly been a very vocal voice on issues at times. I feel like social media, you know, we can go down the social media rabbit hole, and we have in the past. It's, you know, I think it's very easy to get stuck in the cycle of criticizing people from afar. Certainly he could be more vocal about what's going on in U.S. soccer, but you know what, the man is a part owner and he's proud of his investment, and I'm not going to criticize him for that. I think to piggyback on a larger point, which you're getting at here, and following up on Neil's point, which is, you know, the role of athletes and the role of people who are involved in U.S. soccer from the Chicago office. You know, it's tough, right? Because we've seen this happen in the past. We saw Hope Solo try to be a voice for change. And for various reasons, she still could be successful. I mean, she still is out there advocating for change in U.S. soccer, and she's made some very good points. You know, one element we haven't talked about that I'll get to in a minute is youth soccer in this country. But, you know, I certainly think that athletes, especially former national team athletes, do have a role and can be a voice for positive change in this discussion. I mean, especially ones that have a platform on terrestrial media and social media and, you know, all the different ways that they can make their voices heard and such. So I certainly think that former national team players do have a role in this. I don't think they need to be talking about it 24/7 because they'll be the change that's going to make the difference. But I certainly think that if Hope Solo had more company, I certainly think they could move the needle a little bit. The other community that we haven't talked about as much is the youth soccer community. And certainly it's large and diverse in this country, but you know, the people that I talk to and that are friends of ours on this show have said over and over again publicly and privately how much they loathe a lot of the mandates and a lot of the structure that comes down from the Federation. And with every nonprofit organization, there is a process by which change can happen from the grassroots. It's not always easy. In fact, it's usually made not to be easy because you create a governing structure for a reason. But if there's enough of a groundswell against the leadership of an organization, there is a process by which mechanisms are in place where they can force change or they can enforce uncomfortable votes. And I think really the two places you may see that, absent an absolute bombing out of the World Cup, is the youth side of the sport, which has to deal with mandates from the U.S. Soccer Federation that don't improve the game. And, oh, by the way, I just saw the stat that the average age of kid drops out of soccer is 9 years old, which is second only to gymnastics in terms of the age that dropping out of the sport. So we do have a youth crisis in this country in soccer. But also the professional athlete side, where if we have enough professional athletes who are tired of the status quo and aren't dependent upon the Federation for a job or for something else, then I think those are two areas where we may start to see change be pushed upon the Federation simply because they are powerful voices that have a stake in the discussion.
Well, gentlemen, we're going to have to end it there. Our time is up, but we'll definitely try and get together again, and we'll have a part two in all of this, hopefully somewhere down the road once our CONCACAF Nations League moments are done or before MLS Cup Final does come up. But I want to say thank you to all to discuss this situation because it is very alarming. It's very, very troublesome. And I truly believe that we need to find solutions, because if the U.S. Soccer Federation is not going to find the solutions, if you know, they're still going to be getting their own way, you know, maybe we need somebody at a higher authority to find out what needs to be done. But once again, thank you to all of you, and have a good night, and please get home safe wherever you are. I believe Neil's still probably driving to his location, which is probably going home. But thank you all, and I will talk to you all again very, very soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And that will do it for tonight. I want to thank Carter Krishnire of World Soccer Talk, Neil Blackman from Yanks Are Coming podcast, and, of course, Robert Hay from Soccer Minnows. My name's Daniel Feuerstein. Thank you very much for listening to me tonight. Join me tomorrow night as we will review the wild card round of the 2019 MLS Cup playoffs. Have a good night. Take care. And as always, please enjoy your football. Have a good night, everybody. Talk to you next time. And bye-bye for now.